In this episode, we continue the story of family and secrecy with letter 3. If you haven't yet, we recommend that you listen to letter 1 and letter 2 to catch up with this story.
Renowned British composer Leopold Stokowski once said, "A painter paints pictures on canvas, but musicians paint their pictures on silence." We love the images that this quote conjures up. We love how it tries to grasp at how different art forms construct images, ideas, and stories in our minds.
We believe that the power of collaboration can emphasize this effect, and so decided to conduct an experiment.
We brought together postgraduate creative writing students from the University of Lincoln for this research project.
11 writers, 3 months, one project. Could we collaboratively write a literary podcast in the epistolary form? Could we use a writer's room dynamic to create a series, one letter at a time? We ask you to decide.
I am Amy Lilwall.
And I am Sherezade Garcia Rangel. And this is On Silence.
To Woodvale Avenue, London, SE25 2AE, 18th of May, 1978. Dearest Agatha, I'm not sure, after all this time, why I'm even writing this. When I first got here, over a decade ago, I often thought about putting everything down on paper, but never quite got around to it. There was so much to do, so much to look forward to, and I didn't want the past to block the future. I told myself that that was what you and Dad, and of course poor Mother, would want after so much sacrifice. I have no idea how true that is. I only know it's impossible to live fully in two different places at the same time. Actually, I take it back. I do know why I'm writing. It all started last month when I went to the carnival against the Nazis. That wouldn't surprise you, but honestly, it was my first actual march for years. With the kids so young, I couldn't take the risk. There's no Dad here to take care of Lucia and Matthew. That's the twins, who are almost 9 now. Which isn't really a problem, but I have no idea what would become of them if anything happened to me. I guess over the years, my resolve weakened. All the gang were protesting, making sacrifices, taking risks. What was I doing in 76 when the workers were arrested at Grunwick, or the year after when the anti-fascists got hospitalised at Lewisham? Filing letters and keeping house? Telling myself that posters would make a difference? It was never going to be enough. The festival was my glorious return to the front. And it really was a festival, with theatre and circus performers and live music. I even got to meet Joe Strummer. Well, I shook his hand, but close enough. Dad would love his records, if you can get hold of The Clash there. Probably a stretch, unfortunately. One day, I hope we'll all listen to Police and Thieves together. Anyway, all sorts of people from all sorts of backgrounds were there. Punks, soccer fans, and students, and factory workers, and professors. Even the black youth came out in numbers. It was supposed to be wonderful, there in the park, changing the world. But I couldn't enjoy myself. What got to me, what started me on this letter, were the communists. The Marxists and Bolsheviks and Trotskyites, separate but united in the same horrific irony, protesting one form of dictatorship by promoting another. How could I not be dragged back to years ago, back to Czechoslovakia, knowing that if I hadn't left, I would have been protesting against the beliefs of the very people I now stood next to?
Mind the gap. Mind the gap. Mind the gap.
And there was no one I could tell. No one who would really understand. All I have is guilt. Guilt if I do protest, because of the secret anger I feel at my revolutionary sisters and brothers. Guilt if I don't, because I'm betraying the sacrifices my family made. Guilt for having gone, for having left you all behind. Back then, it seemed so obvious, especially after what happened with Mother at the Lake and the stupid, superstitious villagers gossiping, that it should be me. It just felt like it was always supposed to be me. My music, I thought, made me different, special. It offered me a way out. Only all these years later can I admit it could have so easily been you instead. If I could know just one thing, it would be whether you decided to stay or whether you had to because I left. I know what you said, but it can't just be God's will. And I try to believe you're proud of what I've achieved, but I know the truth. I'm the prodigious child who grew up to be a poor secretary with bastard children and a heathen lifestyle. And worst of all, communist friends. It would shame you and it would destroy Dad. At least the villagers wouldn't be surprised. I was always cursed. Which is why I can never post this letter. I hope you can forgive me. I think it's the lesser sin. With love always, Kaya.
Amy got a chance to talk to Martin about Kaya, this very interesting character in the story, and also about his letter. Let's hear the interview.
Letter number 3.
Yeah, how exciting.
Hello, Martin.
Hi.
So first of all, thank you so much for writing that and for contributing to this podcast. It's such a pleasure to hear you read it out loud, because you can identify perhaps certain relevance to in the narrative that you don't get from just reading it, which is lovely. Now, you had the luxury of having Kaya all to yourself, so you then revisit Kaya in letter 12 a little bit further down the line, not to give too much away. So can you tell me, were there any advantages to being in that situation, or would you have liked to explore another character, to have explored another character's perspective? What do you think?
I think for me, like, it was really nice to be given one character and to really be able to invest in that. Yeah, there's always this temptation, right? You always want to kind of bite off more than you can chew. There's loads of interesting characters in this, is one of those things. And so, yeah, there's a part of me that would have loved to have had a go at Agatha as well, for example, the sister, because that relationship with her and Kaya is really vital to kind of what's going on here. However, on reflection, I think probably it was better just to stick to Kaya, because that gave me the opportunity to really think about it, and particularly sort of like going back to the first letter, and you'll hear the second letter, like I could look back and see in my head how I developed her as a character, and that gave me, I think, confidence going into writing the second letter, that I had that part down. I kind of felt like I knew who she was. She's got this really strong motivation for protection, and that's what she's always trying to do, but that creates conflict, because for her, she's having quite a difficult time. Generally, she's trying to deal with her own mental health issues relating to her mother and other things. And so to try and get that right, that internal conflict, and to try and get that into the letters was like a really interesting challenge in its own right. And so I think that was probably enough for me without trying to invest in a second or a third character.
Okay, yeah, no, I mean, from listening to this initial introduction to her, you can tell that she's a feisty character, a survivor, with quite strong political leanings. Did this come to you automatically? Is that the kind of person you wanted her to be? Because with that, as you say, it's creating a conflict, or there's this instinct for protection, but at the same time, that's distancing her from her family, who ultimately are the people that you would want to protect, right? So how did you imagine those layers?
I think there was this thing when I started to think about her biographically and discuss it with the other people that were doing the writing, we were trying to put this together, it's like there was this kind of question. It's like, how does she get from Czechoslovakia to England? What kind of happens there that must affect her? And looking at the dates, it was really obvious that you've got this communist uprising in the late 60s, where there's a suppression of kind of freedom of speech going on by the government, which causes these kind of processes. And so it seemed natural that as somebody that would have been in Prague at the time and as a student studying music, that she would be involved in this. And so it kind of evolved from that very basic idea. You know, sometimes it's really simple. It's like, well, where is this person? What kind of happens in their life and how does that impact them? And this is what drives her politics, I think, is this sense that people should have equality and freedom to be able to kind of speak for themselves rather than the government, you know, be authoritarian. And that kind of drives her. And she feels, I think she feels that she needs to do that, that's really important, even though it kind of to an extent goes against this urge to kind of protect her family. And you can see that conflict in the letter, I hope, that she wants to be out there fighting for people, protecting them almost, you know what I mean? But how does she balance that with being a single parent in 1970s England in relatively low paid work? You know, it's difficult, and that's where I think the conflict for her comes from as a character.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed the fact that you'd made her a musician, which, as you say, puts her, you know, right in the middle of that conflict, because everything's directly affecting her as an artist and indeed perhaps, you know, her future and her children's future, etc. So how she would then respond to that conflict seems really well crafted. You mentioned the context, which I think is very important, not just the uprising, the political uprising, but also the fact that she's in 1970s England. It's clear that you've done a lot of research around this setting. The setting comes through quite powerfully throughout the letter, which is really pleasant. Can you tell us why you thought that was important?
I mean, I think the first thing to admit is that this is a little bit of a cheat. So sometimes when you're drawing a character, you think sort of like, what have I been doing recently that will allow me to kind of really invest in this character? And politics and music are two areas that I've got a strong interest in personally. So these are things that I enjoy in my life. And so there's a little bit of a cheat there, which is, you know, pick on things that you've kind of looked at recently. I think that 1970s context is really important to her. I mean, this is a huge time in England in terms of the fight for equality and women's equality particularly. And the types of jobs that women are doing are changing, their role in society is changing, and that's causing all of this conflict. And you can imagine her arriving in England in, you know, the late 60s after being involved in this big fight and expecting probably England to be slightly different, right? And then she's kind of launched into this, and I think that's really important to her kind of development as a character, that gives us like something outside of what's going on in her family to kind of focus on and be part of. And that's really important. She feels guilty, right, about being here. She feels responsible. She feels like she has to do something to prove that she is worthwhile, the sacrifices that her family have made is worthwhile. And a big part of that is the politics. And I think it's unavoidable. Like, how could you talk about, you know, this character without thinking about the politics of the 1970s and the fight, particularly for equal pay for women, which is so huge at that point in time?
That's interesting. It feels like you've kind of mobilize the context to allow you to build this female perspective. So I think that was one question that I want to ask you. I assume that you're not a mother. Obviously you're a male writer. So harnessing that information, I assume, has helped you to craft that female perspective. Did you find that daunting at all, writing from the perspective of a female character? Is this something that you do often?
Yeah, it's daunting, I think, is the first thing. Like, you worry about getting it right because, you know, well, fairly obviously I'm a man, and therefore, like, how do you put yourself in that place? I talked to the other writers about this, because obviously it's one of those things. And like, how do you approach writing people that are very different to you? How do you get it in, and how do you make that authentic? It can be such a tricky thing. So I think first and foremost, like, you just have to think of them as a person. You have to kind of build them up in the way that you would build any person up in that sense. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's this thing about, like, I think if you're not careful, you're so worried about, are you representing a woman correctly, or are you representing a man correctly, mm-hmm. or, you know, that's different to you, that you forget that actually what you're doing is you're building a character. And so it's always about doing the biographical work and thinking about who this person is and investing in them. What's their motivation? What's their history? Have you taken the time to really try and think through who this person is? Because that's going to affect everything that happens in that letter, right? And sometimes you get it in the writing process. I'm not saying necessarily it's all there right at the start, and you have to go back and edit the character and change your notes. You're like, oh, there's that wonderful thing sometimes where you have that moment of realization, like, oh, that's who they are. Oh. Right. And I don't know if everybody has that. So for me, it's like, yeah, obviously you want to reflect on it. And at the end, you need to look back and make sure that you've kind of got that right, if you see what I mean. Mm. And it's worth, you know, I'm really fortunate in the sense that we've got a lot of very good female writers on this podcast who were able to look at my work and kind of feed back to me and tell me kind of what was going on a little bit there. That felt like I had a little bit of a safety net in that sense. Finally, again, like just another cheat, you know. I'm from a single parent family with a strong political mother. So, and you know, we're back on how do you cheat things a little bit in this sense. Like, some of this normal. Is personal experience, you know. My mum was politically active in the 1970s and the 1980s as a single parent, and I can remember, you know, union meetings. Mum was branch secretary of the local trade union. She stood for local council. One of her boyfriends stood for MP. So we were MP headquarters in my house for a bit. So some of this, it's like, can I reach back into those almost memories in the past and kind of steal some of those? They're a little bit ephemeral, I think. Mm. But there's part of them still there.
Wow, that's fascinating. Thank you. I think you were given quite a tricky task. I've been asking a lot of the writers, you know, what are you trying to communicate to the recipient? But of course, there is no recipient here. Whose decision was it to write a letter that will never be read?
It was me and the other writers in the little group that wrote the first four letters that decided that. So we were in the fortunate position, like, as being the first people to come in and write the letters, we were the people that were going to form these characters and really think about kind of what was going on. And it came out of the simple idea that she wasn't able to communicate with her family, and that was, and then there was a logistical necessity for her not to kind of be able to communicate with her family in that sense. Her sister was, and her were estranged. You know, and that came across clearly in the first letter. So as a jumping off point, it was like, how can we have this person write a letter but also be disconnected, or say, you know, and so it's like, well, you know, it's like, this is obvious, like, she's going to write what would almost be a therapeutic letter. You know, she's disconnected from her family. She's, you know, and so she can't talk to her children. She needs somewhere to put, you know, these feelings. It's like, well, a therapeutic letter is a good way of doing this. So she kind of writes this letter almost to herself. And one of the things I was trying to get across was this idea that almost, like, she's externalizing her own thoughts. She's processing kind of what's going on live. I wanted the letter to feel a little bit organic, and I don't know how well that comes across, but the sense that she was almost discovering her own truth as she was writing the letter, you know, which I think is something that happens to all of us. Maybe I shouldn't, like, assume that happens to everybody. Something that definitely happens to me is that sometimes I find when I'm talking and writing things down that I realise what my actual thoughts are. Like, I don't have that ability always to kind of have that internal dialogue to a full extent. And so I wanted that to come across in the letter, that she's kind of exploring what's going on with her, and this is the only way that she can do it reasonably. She's, you know, she's stuck at home, you know, she wanted to go protesting but has found that problematic because all of a sudden she's realised that she's protesting alongside communists, you know, and she doesn't believe in communism. So she's got no one to talk to. She can't really talk to her friendship group about this because they don't understand it. She can't talk to her family because she's estranged from it. Her children are nine. You can't talk to a nine-year-old about communism and politics. And so it's somewhere to kind of put this stuff for her. And so that's how we kind of came to it. And it's like, and it seemed really obvious once we had this. It was like, oh, yeah, of course she's going to write a letter to herself.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. That's why we have diaries, right? Yeah. But and I think that's why, as a listener, and this is where it gets really nice, because a listener can bring their own interpretation. They can complete the meaning. I think that it feels like the letter that she almost sent. And then she got to the end and was like, ah, oh, don't be ridiculous, I'm not going to send this, which is why I can... It feels like almost self-sabotage in a way when you get to the end and decide, you know, that this letter will just end up in a bin or something. But yes, a really, really lovely idea. Does this process work, do you think? So you've been part of this group since we had our first meeting at the end of May, I think. And now we're at the stage where we're recording the series, which is lovely. So looking back at the process from this point of view, do you think it works?
This is a really difficult question straight away, isn't it? Because it's not, you know, does it work is about the end product. And that's that decision that only the audience really can make in their own way. Basically, do the letters work as a kind of whole and therefore does the kind of podcast work?
The collaborative aspect, I suppose,
I think,
of
like,
writing
something. I think there's an interesting... From my viewpoint as a writer, I found it really hard, I think, because... I'm a bit of a control freak, and one of the things about being a writer is that you get to do it yourself. Do you know what I mean? And yes, sometimes you'll talk to people about it and you have interesting ideas, but you're the person that has the responsibility, you know, and that's terrifying, but also kind of joyous, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And I wish I wasn't quite so much of a control freak, but maybe that's what makes writers, I don't know. So there is this difficulty in... You take something and then somebody comes to you and looks at it objectively, who hasn't been involved in the process, and says, actually, I think it should be like this, or it should be like this, or let's develop the story this way. And there's immediately this little voice in your head going, no, that's not how it's supposed to happen. that isn't what I thought was going to happen. And so that could be quite hard, you know. I mean, and I know, sort of writing about my experience, that was one of these things where I was like, what are you doing? What are you actually doing with my story? And I know that's horrible, and I wish I wasn't like that. But actually, like, the thing about getting to the end and looking back is like, actually, there was a lot of hard work, and there were times when it was really tense in the room. I don't know, like, you were probably listening in on some of the discussions that we were having between the different groups.
A little bit, yeah.
And there were definitely times where it was a little bit tense in terms of the discussions that were going on, I think. But that's a necessary part of the process. Actually, the strange thing is, when you look at it at the other side, like, the collaborative process for me did kind of work in the end. Actually, it was really useful, and it forced me to reflect, perhaps in a way that I wouldn't usually. You know, like, sometimes maybe I'm not harsh enough on myself, I don't punish myself enough for it. Like, it's really hard sometimes to take that step back and look at a work and be like, yeah, okay, that bit's not working, that bit needs to change there, because you invest, you know. This is one interpretation of the Kill Your Darlings idea, right? There are many interpretations of it, but one of them is it's really difficult as a writer to note it, you know, to let go of things when they're just not working. And there was definitely a little bit of this in that process, and that was actually a good thing. I think it's come out cleaner at the other end for having had different people involved in it. And it was really nice at the start of the process to have like 3 or 4 people just to sit down and discuss it. Actually, I think like the 4 or 5 of us that like worked together, so myself and Beth and Joe and Ellie, at the start, like, actually became quite close as part of that discussion, if you see what I mean. It's where we spent a lot of time in each other's company just online, just chatting about this. And that was really nice. It's not something I'm used to as a writer, because you just spend an awful lot of time by
alone,
yourself.
Alone, yeah.
and obviously you've got to like that, do you know what I mean? Yeah. But actually, I just said that. Actually, I don't mind this. This is fine.
There's something quite energising about that collaborative environment, isn't there? Even though it's challenging, yes, especially if you're coming from the point of view of a novelist, prose writer. You do spend an awful lot of time on your own, in control of your own work. So I completely identify with your response there. I've got two final questions to ask you. I think you probably know what they are. The first one is, if you could write a letter to anyone, who would it be? And the second one is, if you could receive a letter from anyone, who would it be?
In my life, just generally.
In your life, beyond your life, in films, in books, imagined people, whoever.
I guess in the last year, if I could write a letter to anybody, I'd like to talk to James Baldwin.
Oh.
I'd like the late, great James Baldwin. And it's just one of those things. I only really discovered Baldwin because he was on the reading list for the Masters, which seems a strange thing to say. But I remember reading Notes from a Native Son and just being blown away by it. As a mixed race writer, there aren't like huge amounts of role models in the sense, in terms of talking about like very literary fiction, which is what I attempt to write, if you see what I mean. Mm. Who are willing to take on kind of like quite controversial issues and really talk about them, but be intelligent about it. It was like wow, this is like a proper intellectual, you know. And I'd just like to write to him, and it'd be interesting to see what James Baldwin made of the world now, right? Of like American politics and the general rise of autocracy across the world, and where he sees kind of race relations and those kind of things. And I know for quite a lot of people, this is quite a dull thing. I'd like to get a letter from James Baldwin. It's like, this is what I think about the world now. Because I just think he'd have some really interesting and fascinating things to say, basically. Mm. In terms of writing a letter, who would I like to write a letter to? So, yeah, I'm going to get quite personal, if that's okay.
Of
so,
course.
My dad died about a month ago. So maybe 2 months ago. It's his funeral a month ago, and his funeral, like, it was a very strange experience. And at some point, when I'm not trying to write a novel, I'm going to try and write a piece of creative nonfiction. I've been reading Joan Didion's A Year of Magical Thinking, and it got me like. Because it's a very strange experience. I don't know my dad very well. So I come from a single parent family. I only really reconnected with him a couple of years ago, and we haven't really had any time to talk about any of the kind of stuff that comes from not knowing this person for 40 years of your life. Really not knowing this person at all, and the time that you did know them being a time when you couldn't really articulate yourself, and there being a whole load of things that you just never really had the opportunity to talk about. And it was really nice to spend time with him, do you know what I mean, and to be able to kind of have that connection and talk about things. But we didn't talk, do you know what I mean, because we were past that point. He was like, by the time I got there, like, he was probably too ill to leave the house. We never really had any time alone. I think we're two people that don't really, people can be really surprised we didn't talk very much. I know, like, listening to me do this interview, people are like, he talks for England, but actually I don't a lot of time. And I shut down and he shut down, and you could see there's this weird moment where you could see that we were related in that sense, do you know what I mean? Both of us just kind of shut down. There's too much to kind of say in that time, and I look at it now and I'm like, oh wow, like, there's so many things that I kind of want to say to you that I needed to say to you, but you were really sick, and your family were there, like your new family, the family that you made after you left this one. I'm not in a position to be able to have this with you. And actually, one of the joys of letter writing is it has a kind of intimacy and a kind of privacy to it, which it can be hard to achieve in the real world. You can't turn around in a room full of people and be like, right, everybody, what I need is like 3 hours alone with my dad, who I've not spoken to in 40 years, do you know what I mean? Because I haven't figured out what I'm going to say, really. You know, and you can't say that in that situation. So the letter would be, yeah, to be able to write a letter to my dad, and just like, right, I think there's probably some things that we need to talk about. Can I start? Because it's been weird for me. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to over-egg it. Do you know what I mean? People have all sorts of problems and issues in their life. But, you know, not knowing your father and then just knowing them briefly, but not long enough to really get there.
Mm.
You know, and to be surrounded by all these people that are really, really close to him and love him dearly. And he's a stranger to you, but you're his only blood relative in the room. It's kind of bizarre, right? It's a brilliant topic for a piece of writing, you know. It's definitely a horrible thing, right? Writers are a bit like this, I think. Like, there's something a little bit cold about it. It's like, oh, this would make a brilliant piece of writing. But
yes.
I'd like to write a letter to my dad. Sorry, that was very long.
It was beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Lovely.
Yeah, I think that's everything.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Martin, for your generous responses and your commitment to the project.
Yeah. Thank you. No, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Good.
On Silence is a research project and a literary podcast written and produced in collaboration with creative writing postgraduate students at the University of Lincoln in the UK.
Listen and explore the power of storytelling and the things left unsaid.
In episode 4, you'll discover more about this fascinating story. You'll hear the next letter and learn about the experience of writing it from our next writer. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at UofLWriting, to keep up with our stories and discover more about this podcast. This podcast was produced by Amy and edited by me. Episode 4 will be coming out soon. We look forward to you hearing it.
I am Amy Lilwall.
And I am Sherezade Garcia Rangel. And this is On Silence.